Today on New Horizons, part two of our interview with former NASA astronaut Barbara Morgan, now Boise State's distinguished educator in residence.
We were an assembly mission of the International Space Station, so we took big things up in the payload bay that we added onto the space station, and we also took like 5,000 pounds worth of stuff that we transferred over. What I love most about doing the robotic operations from inside with this huge arm is it is math in action. Everybody comes with expertise in certain areas and not in others, so we all had lots to learn.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Last week, I interviewed former NASA astronaut Barbara Morgan, Boise State's new distinguished educator in residence. Barbara had so many fascinating things to say about NASA, what it was like to be part of the Teacher in Space program, and her experiences as a mission specialist aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour that we decided to keep talking even after the clock ran out. Today, we are pleased to present the second half of our interview with Barbara Morgan. Did you ever have moments when you're in this freshman class and you're sitting next to this person who has this aeronautical background for 20 years flying everything that flies, and you're coming in as the elementary school teacher who wants to learn and become a mission specialist and go up in space? Are there moments when it's like, wow, this is an intimidating moment for me? And how do they help you learn in a setting like that?
That's a great question. I've got an ear-to-ear grin because you bet. I'm sitting here thinking, oh my gosh. And I'll tell you several stories because they really are fun. But our first introductory class, when they talked to us about what the training, kind of laid out the training for us for the first year. And this is where you learn, they lay out where you're going to learn the T-38 and how to fly it and all the systems. And you're going to learn all the shuttle systems and all the space station systems. And they're laying all this out, and the first thing they said was, this course is going to be high level. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, we're starting out with high level. I'm going to have a heck of a time. And I realized, or somebody, you know, who realized I had the, you know, during the headlights look, realized that it was a language issue for me. In the education world, high level means top, means high level. In the engineering and the NASA world, high level means kind of just the overall basic big picture view. And I can't tell you how many times my thinking was always 180 degrees out from the NASA language meant. So that was a big learning point for me, was first of all learning what the language meant. And once I got the language down, It amazed me how much easier the rest of the learning came. And that was a real lesson for me to take back to the classroom, too, because I'm sure that's what it must be like for our kids, no matter what age. So one of our very first systems classes, I'm looking at an engineering diagram, and I had never looked at an engineering diagram before. And they're walking us through the diagram. So learning how to read that and study that and realize that's where your information is was huge for me. And I remember seeing this little symbol that it was a pump. I learned later, to me, it looked like a hairdryer. So that's the level of that I was coming at. But I'll also always remember one of our early electrical systems classes, and it was fascinating. And my level of understanding of electricity was from very basic third grade electricity, simple circuits, you know, putting together Hershey Kisses and tinfoil and little LEDs, little light-emitting diodes, and sure, a battery, you know, to light up this little light. That was my understanding of electricity, very, very basic. And here we're getting into these, you know, pretty technical electrical systems. And one of my buddies, Neil Woodward, came up to me afterwards. And this is just one of many examples. And he said, Barb, and he was really nice about it. He goes, Barb, I noticed from the questions you were asking that you have a, he was very nice, you have a big interest in electricity. And what he was really telling me was, I noticed that you really don't know a whole lot about it. And so he went on to say, I taught electrical engineering at the university level for several years. And
just to make you feel really good now, right?
but actually, he was doing it in such a kind word. And he said, I would love, if you want, I would love to sit down with you and share this stuff with you. And he did. And that's exactly what all my other classmates did, too. And so he sat with me. We spent several hours together. And he gave me a crash course in basic electricity. And, boy, did it make a difference for how I was able to absorb the rest of the lessons that were to come. And I have to say that wasn't just me either, because everybody comes with expertise in certain areas and not in others. And so those folks who have aeronautical background and engineering background, they did not have the background in the life sciences or in some of the communications and in other areas. So we all had lots to learn. And we all picked each other's brains on that. And I remember the first time we were going for some of our communications classes and some of our media training. Well, I had years of experience being able to talk with our public through the media. And I was having my classmates come up to me and ask me questions. Well, how do you do this? And what do you do? Or asking me, I'm going to work with a kindergarten class and I'm scared to death. You know, what advice can you give me and what can you tell me? So it's a real sharing. So another example of drinking out of the fire hose, which, by the way, Dr. Custer, I am doing here at Boise State University in my very first week, and I think I will be for the first year. But NASA was great. There were several of us, there were a few of us that had not had any really flying experience, and everybody else in our class came with lots of flying experience, whether it was private or whether it was military training and all that and flying. And so they gave us about 20 hours in Cessna. And I'll never forget the very first class went out, and my instructor walked me around the plane and showed me the ailerons and the elevons and the this and that and explained all of it to me. And then we get in, and I knew a little bit about, you know, the basics of how airplanes fly. We get in, and he's showing me the equipment inside, and he says something about ATIS, and we had a short lesson, and I knew usually I'll ask questions if I don't understand. But in fact, at that point, I did say, "And what's ATIS?" And he said, "Well, it's pilot's information that you need to have about the local area before you take off flying, the local weather, things like that, conditions." So I said, "Okay." So he said, "Okay, turn this dial and dial in this frequency." And I know what a frequency is. And he was basically telling me to tune the radio in, and tell them that you are ready. And listen to ATIS. Well, so I did that, and all I heard was, it didn't make any sense at all. There was a lot of static on the radio, and the language that was coming out at me made absolutely no sense. But I thought, okay, I'll do what he's telling me to do. He's my instructor. And then he said, turn to this dial and let them know that you're ready to taxi with Delta. This is out at Ellington Airfield. And I'm looking around. I go, okay, I know it's not Delta Airlines because they're not even out here. And I know a Delta is a change. So maybe he said, tell them that you are ready to taxi with Delta. And I thought, well, maybe what he means is it's a change from where we are out to where we're going. But other than that, I had no idea. And so I asked something about Delta. And he said, well, that was the ATIS you were just listening to. And I thought, okay. And he says, so I thought, I'll monkey see, monkey do. I'll just do what he's telling me to do. And we do take off flying, and it's a wonderful, wonderful flight, wonderful experience. We come back.
Are you flying, or is he flying?
We're both flying.
You're
but
both
he's
back
got
and forth.
He's got his hands on the controls at all times. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's having me experience it and showing me and telling me what's going on.
So you really didn't have to eventually solo. You just had to have the experience of flying. Is that what you were doing in this experience?
Yeah, the reason NASA gave us the 20 hours, and this was great. This was the first time they had done this, because up until that point, you start flying and training right away in the T-38s, which go 500 miles an hour. They are very, very fast. And as backseaters, as mission specialists, we do all the communication, the navigation, and we're also, we do some flying too. We don't take off, we don't land, but we do some of the flying too. But when you're going that fast, things happen really, really quickly, and it's a huge learning curve. And in previous, you know, it was a lot harder for the mission specialists to pick that up really quickly without having any kind of experience at all. Mm-hmm. So that's why NASA gave us a 20 hours to at least get familiar with the language and the flying world before you step into this fast machine where you are expected to pick it up, you know, instantly or within a very short time period. And in fact, after that, NASA now, and in the class after us and from now on, and it's tremendous, that was so successful, just those 20 hours. But that was just, you know, the beginning of what can really happen. And so for the class after us, they sent all the non-flyers to Pensacola to go actually through Navy Instrument Training School, which was tremendous. So they got to learn in the way our military pilots get to learn. You learn in a slower flying aircraft before you jump into a, you know, a high performance jet. So at any rate, back to the story. So we took off, had a wonderful flight, came home, and was all excited, told Clay everything that had happened. And I told Clay about the Delta thing and that I was still a little bit confused. But I knew my instructor would answer, but we didn't have time. So I was saving that for the next lesson. And Clay burst out laughing. And from his years of being a smoke jumper, he's very familiar with the flying world. And he started laughing and he said, "Barb, that was Delta. That was that stands for D. You need to learn the pilot's alphabet." And what I had learned was that every hour that pilot's information for the local conditions changes because the conditions change. So every hour, a new set of ATIS information comes out. And you'll know which set you're on. They just call it by the alphabet that you're on. So it's, you know, 1 hour it's Alpha, the next hour it's Beta, the next hour it's Charlie, the next hour it's Delta. And so that just happened to be the hour that we were on. And he just started laughing. And bless his heart, he went out and bought a radio that I could listen to air traffic control. So I had it in the car back and forth. I was listening as often as I could to ATIS and to the great clearances that air traffic control gives its pilots and things like that, till I could finally go beyond
right.
to actually hearing words and knowing what they meant.
Back to your classes. I'm just curious, since of course we're here at a university where all the students are back in class now and they're getting grades. Did you actually get grades? I mean, like, did you go home at night wondering if you were going to get a B or a C in one of these classes? Or do they treat you like adult astronauts who really don't need to be graded? You just learn.
Actually, that's a great question, too, because it used to be that way. And yes, we did get grades, but what we got more than grades were tests. And it used to be, and that was kind of a change for starting with the class just before ours in 1996. Things got a lot more rigorous. It used to be where everybody would get the training. The training hadn't changed. I mean, it does as you get new systems, but it was still trained in very much the same way, and it's excellent training. But we heard when we came in, and the class previous to us heard that all of a sudden there was a lot of testing going on that didn't used to happen. It was before that you learned it and you did it. And that's a great way of learning. Also, for us, there was a lot of pressure because of all the testing. And there was a lot of complaining, of course, just like I'm sure our students here complain about all the testing. and the grading and all that. But it's simply a tool, and it's a tool to help you learn it. And it helps you focus on what's important and what are the things that you need to know. Mm-hmm. So it was all good. And actually, it was great. And it also brought the class much closer together. And it brought us closer together with the other classes as well, because, and I think this also comes from the military, and this is something I learned, there's stuff called gouge. And gouge is information. Here's what you really need to know. And they call it foot stomping. So they'll stomp their foot when it's something you need to know. And so we would take turns on our classes when we knew a test was coming up. We would take turns putting together all the notes, you know, from that everybody had kind of taken from class, from the various classes, and condensing it into what's the most important stuff to learn. And we would get together and you'd study it on your own, but we did a lot of group study and a lot of sharing of information. Mm-hmm. And then we also, our classmates from the class before us, was sharing their gouge with us. Well, here's what the test was like last year, and here's what you're probably going to get
this
asked.
This sounds really familiar now.
It was great, and then we passed it along as well. So it's a tool for both learning, but it's also a tool for team building.
You're listening to Barbara Morgan. She is a former astronaut, and she is now the Distinguished Educator in Residence at Boise State University. The class versus the crew. How large is the class? Well, you already told us how large the class was, but I guess my question is, are there some of these folks who never really do get into a crew because they never quite make the cut, but they're still part of the program and they're assisting on the ground, but they never go up? I would assume that's the case. That happens.
Now, in our class, every single person who went through the class, everybody does well.
Oh.
And everybody flies. We have one person who is not flying only because that person chose to do something else and actually had an opportunity to go to headquarters and work on the new vehicle on the Orion. And was that's a great opportunity that he couldn't pass up. Everybody flies.
This training, of course, all leads up to that moment when you get your assignment. And one of your assignments, I mean, in addition to being the educator astronaut who had all these responsibilities on the ground and around the country, talking to teachers and talking to students, your responsibility when it comes to getting up to the International Space Station was to work the shuttle robotic arm. I wonder if you could help us understand what that experience was like, both in from the standpoint of learning it and practicing and then actually doing it.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to talk about that. It was one of my favorite things to do. And also the space station robotic arm. We've got two robotic arms. They're similar, but they also have differences in the, and they're both really, really fun to fly. What I love most about doing the robotic operations from inside with this huge arm, either on the station or on the space shuttle, is it is math in action. And it's geometry in action in particular, but it's there's a lot of different aspects of mathematics to it. But it is so much fun, all that stuff that you studied in school, and you see it come together and you actually get to do it. It is really, really fun. So one of my favorite jobs, we were an assembly mission at the International Space Station, so we took big things up in the payload bay that we added onto the space station, and we also took a bunch of like 5,000 pounds worth of stuff inside that I can talk about later that we transferred over. But the two big pieces of equipment that we took, one was a truss piece that went way out on the end of the truss. That is a big, it's like a beam in a ceiling that goes across the top of the International Space Station. And on both ends of it, it holds the solar arrays that provide the energy for the station. And we added a little piece that went on the end that was kind of a spacer between one set of arrays that was there that a previous crew had attached and a set of arrays that's going to be coming up in the future to add onto the end as we complete the station. And we did that. That was fascinating because we did it robotically using both the space shuttle and the space station arm, and we did it with space walkers. So we lifted this truss piece out of the payload bay with the shuttle arm. Now, if I wish I had a model to show you on the radio.
I've seen you do that on a video.
Video. But we're talking way out. The space station is the size of two football fields put together. That's the footprint. So the shuttle is basically attached to the middle part of that. As you take the piece out with the shuttle arm, you can't reach way out to the end of this two football field lengths. So we handed it off to the space station arm. So we had a couple of our crew members inside the space station at that robotic workstation grabbing this piece. So we basically did a handshake, hand to hand, and then we went to bed that night. And what happened there, the space station robotic arm, it can be moved. It's like an inchworm, and either end can be attached to things, so it can move like an inchworm. And it can be attached in different places. So on one end, we had the truss piece. The other end, at this point in time, it was attached to a transporter, a mobile transporter that's like a little railroad car on these two rails that run up and down the length of this long truss. And while we were in bed sleeping overnight, the ground team, Mission Control, commanded that mobile transporter to move all the way out as far as it could to the end of that truss. Then the next morning, we sent out two of our spacewalkers. They very carefully made their way out to the end with these, and they had tools, special, basically, bolt drivers, like Makita drills. And our space station operator, arm operator, took that truss piece, and at that position, the arm could reach all the way around and position that truss piece on the end. Meanwhile, our two spacewalkers were saying, okay, a little bit left, a little bit right. We had about 2 inches of clearances to bring it in without hitting anything that was critical. And then they took their bolt drivers and bolted it into place. So that part was done with both robotics and with spacewalkers. The other piece that we took in the payload bay, and I'm particularly proud of this one because Tracy and I were the arm operators for that, and I had my hands on the controls the whole time doing the operating, and Tracy, as my partner, was helping make sure that I was doing everything correctly. Great partner. That was a stowage platform for spare parts, and it weighed 7,000 pounds. So we took the shuttle robotic arm, very carefully grabbed onto it, very carefully pulled it out of the payload bay. And it's all done with mathematics, and it's very fun. And then we reached around again, handed it to the space station arm. The space station arm did this big, it's like with its elbow, did a huge flip of its elbow, took it and placed it all the way on top of the space station. And then while that arm was doing that, our commander and I floated over to the International Space Station, and using a small computer, just a laptop IBM computer on board, we sent a series of commands to automatically activate the latching equipment to latch that piece into place. So that construction was done all robotically from inside the space station.
As I listen to you talk, I realize what a poor job we do in our society of documenting and recognizing people who have accumulated expertise and stored knowledge. And here at the university, we give out bachelor's degrees and master's degrees, and they're very official, and they're based on X number of courses. If you added up everything you've done over the last 20 years, and we organized it in some form of the kind of coursework we give our students, you have at least a master's degree, Barbara. I don't know. We've already given you an honorary doctorate, and that's so appropriate because I think you have the equivalent of it anyway in real live coursework and training. And that leads me, we're going to run out of time here in this second half of our interview, and I want to give you a moment to speak about one of our goals here at Boise State, which of course is the reason why you were hired to come aboard this university. STEM education is very important to Boise State, and for our listeners who may not know what that means, it's science, technology, engineering, and math, and we talk about it all the time here, and our goal is to improve students' understanding of opportunities in science, technology, engineering, and math, and help younger students in particular develop an appreciation for and even respect for careers in those fields. So here you are. I know you're only the first week on the job, so you don't have to tell us all you're going to do, but give us your thoughts, if you would, about the importance of this task. And of course, I would only add that if there is anybody on this planet who's perfect to deliver this message and to make this happen, it's a former elementary education teacher who is now a very sophisticated scientist, as our listeners have just learned. Please.
Well, I probably beg to differ, but thank you very much. You're very kind. I'm really, really, I'm very, very excited about this opportunity. I'm really proud of Boise State University for taking a lead in this. And it truly is lifelong education. And the bridges that Boise State has already built that I hope to be able to help strengthen and expand on between our K-12, our classrooms, our kids out there, and the university, so that the kids picture themselves here and they're excited to be here and in all areas, but particularly in science, technology, engineering, math. And that's for the kids who aren't going into those fields as well, to get that stardust on them, to get the real stuff on them so that they get a chance to experience the joy of experimenting and the joy of exploring and the joy of discovering and the joy of being part of a team of people who are working on a goal bigger than any one individual. And that's the stuff that's going on in this university and the things that we'll be able to both bring to our students and our teachers, because that's how we teach our children best, is through our teachers. And our teachers want those opportunities too. And that's my goal. That's what I'm hoping that we can do, is just expand, let everybody be able to have the kinds of opportunities that my colleagues and I were fortunate enough to have and make sure that we expand those.
My recollection of my elementary and secondary schooling experience is that I really didn't have the opportunity to develop that joy of discovery, that the approach to courses in those days was simply not about hands-on learning. And these days, I gather, and you can comment on this, both in elementary and secondary education, we've moved away to some extent anyway from the 50-minute lectures and have attempted, at least in science, to bring the laboratory into full and complete focus and to place the student in the middle of that laboratory and turn them loose.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've come a long ways. I think we still have a long ways to go, but we've definitely come a long ways. And we have great teachers all over this state who are not only bringing those experiences into the classroom, but getting knocking the four walls and getting their kids out into the world and getting those things as well. And what I love, like here at the university level, one of the things that excites me so much about this, not only being a great teaching university and not getting rid of that, but keeping that because that's so important, but also really becoming a research university, is that means in addition to all the great knowledge that will be generated here, and that's very, very exciting, but it also means that when students, whether they're university students or whether there are K-12 students who come here as K-12 students, that not only when they do their science classes, do they get a lab experience? It's not a lab experience necessarily just to illustrate a point, so it's not really science because the answer's already there. Mm-hmm. But they get right to really engage in the unknowns of research and experience that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really key. And that's what we'd like to bring to our students in their classrooms as well.
Our College of Engineering, under the leadership of Dean Cheryl Schrader, has focused primarily on underrepresented groups when it comes to moving into elementary and secondary education in particular. And we do know that young women somehow drop off the track and simply don't follow through on a career in science and math, and that's one of the principal challenges. As an elementary school teacher, do you have any thoughts or clues on what goes on there and what goes wrong in that movement through elementary school? And why is it that we have this particular challenge getting young women interested in science and math and keeping their interest through and into their careers?
Yeah, that is a challenge, and there have been a lot of studies and a lot of reports that have been done on that, and we are on the right track here and doing the right things, getting the girls the experiences early on, but keeping them at those key times too, especially that middle school age when you know, other interests and peer pressure and images, how you see yourself and all that become really, really important. Mm-hmm. And we're doing the right thing, and we'll continue to work on that. But I'd also like to say it's not just young women. You mentioned other underrepresented groups, and also we've got young men who haven't had the experience that they might think, gee, that is something I might really like. And so I think it goes across the board.
Well, Barbara, you are certainly the person to stand up before a group of young people and talk about this. And we're just so excited to have you here at Boise State. We've run out of time for this interview, but we'll have an opportunity to bring you back on the show after you've been around here for a little while and tell us how we're doing and what we're doing. But in the meantime, it is an absolute delight to have you as Distinguished Educator in Residence here at Boise State. Thank you for joining me today on New Horizons.
Well, thank you, Dr. Custer, and I count it a great blessing to be able to be here, so
great.
Thank you so much.
You. Next week, an encore interview with Greg Mortensen, co-author of Three Cups of Tea, the first-year read at Boise State for 2008. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Craven. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.